Just give me one second. Okay, we are going.
We are good. So we're starting a new session or semester or just series of classes. I think it's like just three or four classes. And we thought we would talk about the holidays because the main holiday that's coming up, of course, the Jewish one is Hanukkah. There's also a Thanksgiving holiday coming up. And we want to talk a little about some of the themes of Thanksgiving that are kind of Jewish in nature. But what we wanted to, what I wanted to do tonight is really talk about the concept of holiness in general, because they really relate to the way we celebrate any of these special days. Before we do that, though, what are the Jewish holidays? Let's just run through them really quickly. There's actually, I would say, three categories of Jewish holidays. The high holidays, the festivals, and then two other holidays, which we'll call them the rabbinic ones. Okay. So what are the high holidays? Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Actually, when do they technically start? There's something even before Rosh Hashanah that you may not even be familiar. I wrote a book called The 40-Day Challenge because there's a 40-day period from when until when that really encapsulates the entire high holiday period. It's 40 days, actually. And that's from... Now, Tisha B'Av is actually... I mean, it is really a holiday. We don't think of it a holiday. It's a commemoration of the destruction of the temple. But I'm not. I don't want to discuss tonight the fast days or the tragic days. That is a very important day, the 9th of Av, when we commemorate the destruction of both of our temples. But what happens after Tisha B'Av that kicks off the high holiday season? It's a little obscure. It's not terribly well known. Okay, it's the beginning of a Hebrew month called Elul. Elul is the month after Av. Av is the saddest month on the Jewish calendar. Elul is probably the holiest. Because Elul begins the 40-day cycle that takes us all the way. What's 40 days from Elul, actually? Yom Kippur. And Elul, the Rosh Chodesh, which is the first day of Elul, was the actual day that God came to the Jewish people through Moses and said, I'm going to give you a second chance. After what incident in Jewish history? What's that? The sin of the golden calf, which took place 3 weeks before Tisha B'Av. And Moses then for 40 days prayed to God for forgiveness. And God said, fine. 40 days after Yud Zayin B'Tammuz is Rosh Chodesh Elul. 40 days from Rosh Chodesh Elul is Yom Kippur. You see, all of these things don't just fall out randomly. They happen for a reason. The reason we start our high holiday season with Rosh Chodesh Elul is because that was the day that God said, I'm going to give you guys a second chance. You messed up the first time with the sin of the golden calf, but I'm going to give you another chance. And then Yom Kippur became the Day of Atonement. Why? Because 40 days from Rosh Chodesh Elul was Yom Kippur. What happened on that day? When God said to Moshe, I'm going to give you a second chance, what did that really mean? Come back for a second set of tablets. What happened to the first set of tablets? Exactly. He dropped them, he forgot them. What happened? Moshe smashed them because what did he see when he was coming down with them? He saw the people sitting around the golden calf. Moses prayed, begged God for forgiveness. He was the best defender. We have some lawyers here. He was the best defense attorney ever. He got our people out of a lot of pickles. He was quite convincing if you look at his arguments. And 40 days later, after the sin of the golden calf, he's invited back up to Sinai. Spends the next 40 days getting the second tablets and the Torah. Comes down on what day? Yom Kippur. That's why Yom Kippur is the holiest day on the Jewish calendar. Because that was the day he came down with this new opportunity for a renewed relationship with God. Fine. That's the high holidays. What are the three festivals? Sukkot. What else? We can do them in order. The first one on the Jewish calendar we had already. It's right after Rosh Hashanah, right after Yom Kippur, 40 days after Yom Kippur. It's Sukkot. What's the next one?
Simchat
Torah. Well, so that's all part of Sukkot. Simchat Torah, Shmini Atzeret, it's all part of Sukkot. What's the second and the third of the festivals?
Pesach.
Passover, good. And? Shavuot.
Pesach, Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot. Why do we call these holidays regalim? They're not only called festivals, they're also called regalim from the word regel, which means foot, because they're all pilgrimage holidays. They were all holidays that the Bible, the Torah, commands the Jewish people to trek to Jerusalem, bring the special offerings. Fine. Pesach, Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot. What other holidays are there? Jewishly? What are the other ones? Hanukkah and?
Purim.
So there are these minor festivals. Tu B'Shvat is one of them. Tu B'Av is another one. And they do commemorate important things, but they're considered minor, because what really makes a holiday a festival? We don't work. There's actually a prohibition of melacha on those days. That's what gives it the sanctity of the day. Except Purim and Chanukah are what kind of ordained holidays? They're different than Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot, because they came about through
the rabbis.
They're actually post-biblical holidays. Because what was the Chanukah story? And I'm going to give a whole class about Chanukah in a couple of weeks. That was, when did that happen, that story? That took place?
Second Temple era,
after the close of the Bible. So obviously could not have been in the Torah. And that was the attempt by the Greek Hellenists to stamp out Judaism, not Jews, Judaism. Purim was an attempt by Haman and some of his Persian cohorts to stamp out not Judaism, I'll hold you responsible, to stamp out not Judaism, but Jews. Big difference between Hanukkah and Purim, by the way. The reason we celebrate Hanukkah spiritually, how do we celebrate Hanukkah? We light a candle. It's very sweet. But there's no physical kind of celebration. We're going to talk about that tonight. It's a very spiritual celebration, lights, candles, as opposed to Purim, where we dress up like a Jewish Mardi Gras a little, and we drink, and there's a mitzvah to eat a meal, because what was at stake, Purim, Haman, didn't really care what your ideology. You could become a really good Persian Zoroastrian, that was the religion back then in that part of the world, and he still would have killed you. It was no different than Hitler. It was after Jewish blood, but not Antiochus and Hanukkah, or the Greeks. They were not interested. They actually went against what they wanted to do by killing Jews. They wanted to kill Judaism. That's why we celebrate one physically, one spiritually. So those are the holidays, basically. Let's do review quick. High holidays, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and it starts with Rosh Chodesh Elul, the whole 40-day thing we talked about. Then you have the three regalim, the trek to Jerusalem, right? Sukkot, Pesach, Shavuot, and then Purim and Chanukah, post-biblical, rabbinically ordained holidays. Yeah?
Question. When did we start celebrating the holidays and the three festivals? Like, was it in the desert, or when was it?
So the first Passover was kept when?
Passover?
So there is such a midrash, there's a part of rabbinic literature that suggests that some of the patriarchs, matriarchs, were so spiritually in sync that they were able to naturally intuit what would later be revealed in the Torah. But let's not go there right now. When was the first Passover observed? Then, what did God tell the Jewish people? What's that? That's funny. You hear what he said? It's like, run. Besides telling them to get the heck out of Egypt, yeah, what else did he tell them to do? Take the blood of the Paschal offering, right, and take its blood and put it on the lintel, and I'm going to pass over. And he also told them to eat maror and matzah. It's in the Torah. The first Jews who left Egypt actually had a Seder. Okay, so that, just to answer your question, that holiday was observed right away. We also believe that Shavuot was observed right away, because there's a custom to eat what on Shavuot? What kind of foods? Okay, not cheesecake per se, but
dairy.
Why dairy?
Because
they didn't know the rules of keeping kosher, which we're going to talk about in a minute, also. So therefore, to keep it simple, They just ate dairy.
So they were doing that in the wilderness too. We also believe that our ancestors lived in huts during their 40-year sojourn in the wilderness. That's why we sit in huts on Sukkot. So all these things really go back, to answer your question. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, I mean, it's in the Torah, so I don't have historical records to prove this, but it would stand to reason that the next year after the Torah was given, they followed the procedure in the Torah for Yom Kippur, or Rosh Hashanah. Yeah. Yeah, Jordan.
So I'm a little bit confused. So I recognize the fact that often we eat and we write on Pesach, maybe to represent the Paschal lamb, fine. But at that point, we still did receive the laws in terms of we eat and not eat. So I don't understand why we do it for one and not the other.
Meaning, why wouldn't we be confused by on Passover, just like
we... Why would we still eat dairy? Why wouldn't we still eat dairy on Pesach? It was the same idea that we didn't know the kosher animal laws at that point yet either.
That's an interesting question.
Right, but we
I mean, that's the technical. Yeah, the technical.
They told us to eat the can.
So the technical answer is that the Torah was, you know, there was the Torah was not given at Sinai yet. That's very interesting. I didn't even think about that so much. In other words, there was this period of time when we observed the holiday of Passover. You know, Jews circumcised their sons. For how long before the Torah was given? Since Abraham. Okay? There were actually 7 Noahide laws from the times of Noah, plus the 8th was circumcision. But you and I, or our parents, performed the circumcision today because of a separate verse in the Torah. And on the 8th day you shall circumcise. But until that point it was kept because God himself was telling the Jews what to do. But you and I are not keeping it for that reason. You and I are keeping it because we have this Torah and it instructs us how to observe this. But I'm getting way off. I want to talk about what does it really mean to be holy. Because these are holy days. And it's a very highly misunderstood concept, I think, in life and certainly in Judaism. If I asked you right now, give me a name of someone you think is holy. Or what kind of activities, or what kind of lifestyle sort of just pops into your mind when you think about a holy person.
You.
That's very sweet.
No,
alibi. Yeah, yes. A nice, meaningful Shabbat dinner. Kiddush. That's the same word. Actually, that's very important. I'm going to come back to that. The word in Hebrew for holy is kadosh. That's what we make every Friday night. We make the kiddush. Yes? It could be either one. You could give me a name of someone. It could be like the Dalai Lama. You think it sounds like a holy person. Or it could be, you know, someone who does this.
Yeah, I was thinking just Jewish terms. You sanctify, you kadesh your wife or spouse, vice versa. I don't know if there's even another thing. You know,
so the word for getting married, believe it or not, does anyone know this? The word for getting married is called kiddushin. Same thing we do Friday night. Okay, when someone is honored, I do a lot of weddings. It's one of the perks of my job. So what do they call the officiant at a Jewish wedding? What's his name? It's called the Mesader Kiddushin. He's the one who arranges the Kiddush. So, I mean, that's weird. You make Kiddush over the couple? And what's holy about a couple? Okay, they're in love. They want to get married. That's nice. What does holiness usually mean in our Western society? It usually refers to some very spiritual dude who's contemplating and meditating, maybe going off to some, like in the Himalayas or somewhere.
Tibet.
You know, what's that?
Tibet or Nepal.
Yeah, well, one of those parts of the world where the real holy spiritual people go. Because when I talk to people, that's the impression I get from our perception of being a holy, holy person. What is holiness as far as Judaism is concerned? And to answer this question, we really have to ask ourselves what mitzvot in Judaism actually does the Torah command us to keep to be holy? Does anybody take a stab at it? What commandments does the Torah want us to observe to be holy? You would think. Doesn't say that. You would think a Shabbos is such a holy thing. By the way, it goes exactly according to what I'm trying to share of our major perception of holiness. Shabbos, when I sort of pull myself out of the physical world, I refrain from all these physical activities. I'm just sitting around, and we're praying a lot, we're singing songs. It's beautiful, that's holy. But actually, what are the commandments in the Torah that God says, keep this commandment and you will be holy? It's counterintuitive. What are you going to say?
That was, I think, the final verse in Shema. Talk about wearing tefillin.
Tzitzit.
Wear these tzitzit and
you'll remember. But it doesn't say holy by the tzitzit. What's the point of the tzitzit? Of the, it'll serve as a reminder of God, but it's not holy. Two very strange mitzvot that don't seem to be holy producing activities. Baron? Nope. That's an interesting suggestion. That would feel like a very holy thing also. That's the last rites, the Jewish last rites, a group of men that wash the body of a man who's passed away in the waters of the mikveh, dress the body in simple white shrouds, place the body in the coffin, or the women do this for women. It's called the Chevra Kadisha. That's not... What would you say?
What he said, it goes on to say, the mantis keru, vayitem kedushim lelechem. Keru, so the holiness there, maybe it relates to memory. If you remember, you will be holy unto your God.
Remember what?
The mantis keru, vayitem kedushim lelechem.
Remember God.
I have to see.
But what are the direct mitzvah that the God says it explicitly? Two areas. Kashrut and sexuality. Keeping kosher. And, in fact, the great Maimonides, anyone heard of Maimonides, who lived in the 1100s in Spain, he was the first to codify all of the Talmud. And he deliberately chose names, titles of his 14 different books called the Mishneh Torah, under which would fall all of the different rules and laws of Judaism. And he had one book he called Sefer HaKadusha, the Book of Holiness, and in it he put two areas of halakha, of Jewish law. Ma'achalat asurot, forbidden food items, like what's kosher, what's not kosher, and Hilchot Isurei Bia, the laws of forbidden sexual relationships. And it's a little weird, if you think about it. What does sex and food have to do with holiness? Because Shabbos, or even attending to the dead, or remembering God, like all those seem like really holy things, but like what I eat, who we are intimate sexually with, I'm not saying those are not important things, but what does that have to do with being holy? And I want to read to you something that I saw in the writings of a great Jewish philosopher, Dayan Grunfeld. He wrote an amazing book we have in the library called The Jewish Dietary Laws. And he wrote that the major conception of religion in the West is the stuff having to do with our spiritual side. Right, that, and therefore religion is really mainly concerned with things like prayer, worship, but our worldly activities, and especially the trivial mundane things like eating, food and drink, or sexual relations, which just seems like part of what we do in terms of the physical side of who we are, have little to do with spirituality or with our moral and ethical development. And here's where Judaism is different. And here's where the definition of holiness, insofar as Torah is concerned, is distinct from any other civilization. The Torah does not use the word religion, because to the Torah, every facet of human life, says Rabbi Grunfeld, even the most trivial and smallest, is potentially a sphere of religion. To take one part of life and to say, this part of my life is religious, and this part is not. You know, I have my work, I have my friends, yes, I go to synagogue, that's what I do here. there could be nothing more antithetical to what Torah stands for than to decompartmentalize our lives in such a way. Judaism is aiming to hallow life. And where is life lived? Okay, we spend time in synagogue, and I congratulate you guys for coming here tonight to learn and to study with us. That's a big part of our lives. But let's face it, where do we spend most of our lives? We spend most of our lives in the office, in the kitchen, and in the bedroom, and in just regular stuff. And if you look at the corpus of Jewish law, how many commandments are there in Judaism? There are 613 mitzvot, 248 positive commandments, 365 negative. Almost most of them deal with regular everyday life stuff. There's a lot having to do with prayer and Shabbat. But you know that three out of the four sections of what's called the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, written in the 1500s by Rav Yosef Cairo, he codified all of Jewish law. He came after Maimonides, and he used Maimonides as one of his great sources. He has four sections in there. When you become a rabbi, you have to become like an expert in one or two of the sections. I don't know why, who chose it, but it's usually the laws of Kashrut. Probably because most communities couldn't afford both a rabbi and a shochet and a kosher butcher, so that's probably how it started. But it's very, very interesting. Three out of the four sections of Jewish law deal not with the devotional, the prayers, the Sabbath, Yom Kippur, Tzitzit. That is all subsumed in the section called Or HaChaim. But the other three areas, you know what the other three areas are? Let's see if I have this here. Yoredea, Jewish dietary laws. Evin HaEzer, Jewish family laws. Have to do with marriage, sexuality. Choshen Mishpat, laws having to do with acquiring property, commercial life. Got some lawyers here. Torts, negligence, all that kind of stuff. Three out of the four sections, only one out of the four sections of the Shulchan Aruch deals with what most of us associate religion. Prayer, the Sabbath, and so on and so forth. The other stuff, which is real everyday life, my ox gores your ox. My car smashes into your car. Okay, how do I deal with that? Oh, I don't know that. Why would Judaism have anything to say with that? I'll go to the courts for that. Well, where do you think a lot of the courts got the principles and the precedents for British common law, which is the source for much of Western legal systems, comes from the Bible, comes from the Torah? Or what happens if I'm criminally negligent, or I'm just negligent, you know, in some area of my life, and somebody gets hurt as a result? The Torah has so much to say about this. That's in the Shulchan Aruch, that's in the Talmud, that's discussed extensively, and that's just as important as praying in synagogue or observing the Sabbath. And he says, and I just want to just end this quote from here, it's a beautiful line. He says that, to be religious means to think of all human activities as being within the Torah framework. And that's why we call Judaism a Torat Chaim, the Torah of life, not just parts of life, but life. No aspect of life, he writes, individual or collective, devotional or commercial, is outside the rule of God and His law. A holy nation means, in the philosophy of the Torah, not a nation which is ruled by a priestly caste, but a commonwealth whose every home is a temple, and every table an altar, where the fields and the meadows, the workshops and marketplaces, the offices, homes, and kitchens are just as much the scenes of divine service as the house of worship and the house of study. And if you think about it, what are the three basic human cravings that each of us possess, right? And each one has a section in the code of Jewish law: food, sex, and power. Food is Yoredea, sex is Evin HaEzer, and acquisition or power is all the laws of Choshen Mishpat. I get into a property line dispute with my neighbor, right? The way I resolve that issue is just as important as how I pray in the synagogue on Yom Kippur. And what's happened in America is that because we live in essentially a Christian country, and Christianity doesn't have this all-encompassing kind of law for every single little thing that we do in our life, we kind of relegate. And we say, you know, Judaism is there for my bar mitzvah, my bat mitzvah. I'll have to call a rabbi when I get married because I gotta get married according to the Jewish law, which is important. And God forbid, after 120, they're putting us in the ground, you need the rabbi there too. And all these sort of Jewish life ceremonial kinds of things, and the high holidays and Passover, but the real everyday stuff, that's really where God also wants to be included. And I always say, it's easy to be holy in synagogue. Put on a nice suit, put your kippah on, behave nicely, pray, you're a holy person. But try to be holy at work. When everyone's stabbing each other in the back, try to be holy when we eat. Try to be holy in our most intimate relationships. Because that's really where the greatest challenge of holiness takes place. And that's really, I think, where Judaism shines, by giving us an approach to those parts of our lives. And I'll just quote this prayer, Ki hem chayenu varachimenu, we say it every day in the prayers, that Judaism is a way of life. It's a spiritual path to life. Whether you like it or not, you and I, we're created. We are physical beings. So to the degree that we bring in spirituality into our physical lives is the degree that we are holy. Can you really say you're holy if we're really just holy here? You know? That's probably where we can connect the word holy, H-O-L-Y, with holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y. To be a wholesome person. I used to love the God... You guys have never watched the Godfather movies? Any Godfather?
Yeah.
So you know like that opening scene in Godfather where Michael Corleone is like... They show him in church at his grandson's christening and he looks really religious and holy. He's like crossing himself in this like very intense Catholic church kind of like... And then they flip him and they show what he's doing like on a Tuesday. He's like killing somebody. He's like beating the living daylights out of somebody and he's extorting some other guy in his business. And that is... And I'm not saying every religion has its hypocrites. I'm not saying this is unique to Christianity. I'm not trying to say that. But that kind of dichotomy is something we want to really just rid ourselves of and ask ourselves, how are we living our everyday lives as holy people? How do we speak to each other at work? If we have colleagues, if we have bosses or people who work for us, how do we eat? How do we engage in our most intimate relationships? Because that, as I say, is a greater test of holiness than anything else. I have one last thing about holiness I want to share, but any comments or questions just about anything I've mentioned here? That's the main idea I wanted to share with you guys tonight. I want to get a little deeper. I know it's late, but I want to get a little deeper because the last 7-8 years of my life, I started delving a little more into the Kabbalah, into Jewish mystical tradition. I'm not saying I'm certainly nowhere near being anywhere near a real teacher of Kabbalah or expert in this area, but I've been studying Torah my whole life, and they say you're not supposed to study this stuff until you're 40, whatever, so I started getting into it. And my son in Israel is very into this and has a pretty good handle on it, actually. So, talked a little more before about being holy. Transcendental meditation. Anybody here meditate? Great thing to do. Really important. And it's a very important Jewish practice. Prayer, certain aspects of prayer are also meditations. But what is the ultimate goal of spirituality in Judaism? We talk about transcending the physical, finite world. The goal in Judaism is not to escape physical reality. The goal in Judaism is to be able to imbue physicality with spirituality. Now, here I would say this is probably the most fundamental distinction between Torah and the more Eastern religions, Buddhism amongst them. And there's a lot of very beautiful things in Buddhism in particular. But I would say that this is the fundamental difference, which is never to negate the physical world. Now, we believe that we are composite of body and soul. So the part of you that's holy, of course, is the soul. The part of you that's just like an animal is the body. So you would think the best thing you could possibly do is just ignore the body and just live an ascetic life and find some mountaintop and go and meditate. And the more you can refrain from eating and enjoying physicality, the more you could just sort of tap into your soul and ignore your body, the holier of a person you are. You have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to say the mind and body is really connected, and one of the ways it's connected to is that your brain controls like all the limbs, like your body, so really it's just like you, yourself, like your entire self is all connected, like mind, body, movements, that.
Yeah, you're bringing up a big, big area. So when I'm talking about the body, I'm also including the brain, which can get complicated because when the rabbis and the sages talk about the soul, consciousness and the human intellect is involved in that, and of course that starts with the brain. But it's a very good point. The goal is to unite the mind, body, and soul together to be connected to God. But the brain is really part of the body as far as Judaism is concerned. But getting back to this idea of, so we have this animal, physical part of us, and we have a more of a spiritual part of us. And the mitzvot, which are the commandments, are really, what's their purpose? Why do we perform all these commandments? I mean, okay, God said so. And if you believe in God, and he's, you know, maybe you didn't understand everything your parents always, but you trust that they know better. And they have your back, and they care about you. So that could be a motivation simply to listen to God, because the finite human mind can only fathom so much wisdom and knowledge. God is the ultimate infinite mind, and he's a benevolent God. He cared enough about me to will me into existence, so it makes sense that I should listen to him. But what's the purpose, what's the function of the mitzvot in terms of what metaphysical, spiritual impact are they supposed to have on us? Because think about the mitzvah for a minute. Almost all of the mitzvah pertain to our physical everyday lives. They're not simply pray. They're not simply, and even when you pray, what are you doing when you pray? If you take the most spiritual mitzvah in the world, guess what? What parts of your body are involved actually when you physically pray? Your mouth, your lips, your tongue, your palate, your teeth. Because when you pray, you're supposed to actually move your lips. You're not supposed to, I always say, we don't pray with our eyes, we pray with our lips. It's very important for you to hear, us to hear the words when we say them. Psychologically, anyone who's been in therapy knows this. That to think something is one thing, but to hear yourself say it is something completely different. It will only have an impact on you. Remember, Soloveitchik wrote this, that repentance contemplated but not verbalized will not have the impact. So when you pray, when any of us prays, we're still involving the body. Some people also do this when they pray. You ever see this? People moving around a lot. They want to involve the body as much. When my kids were little, they would come home from school, from Jewish school, and they would be reciting verses from the Torah in a little sing-song. And I used to think that the rabbis did that because they keep, you know, it's easier for them to memorize things when it's a song. But there's another reason. Because the more you involve the physical body in the performance of the mitzvot, and here I'm quoting from the great Baal HaTanya, Rav Shneur Zalman Liadi, was a great, lived in the 1700s, was a great Kabbalist. And he taught that the more you involve the physical body in the keeping of the mitzvot, the more you are elevating and the more holiness you're bringing into what? Into physicality. The goal of a mitzvah is not to get you to be removed from your body. The goal of the mitzvah is to get your body to be inspired and imbued with spirituality. So rather than us trying to leave this world and go into some other world, which we'll have plenty of time after 120 to do, the goal of this world is to take some of that and bring it down here. The goal of Judaism is to take holiness, is to make the physical world a holy place. And I'll prove it to you. It's not 100% proof. Why, and I'm just curious if you've ever thought this or asked this, why do you think God, from God's perspective, He created us? The way we define God, God has no needs. He wasn't lonely. He needs to create these little playthings, bump into each other. It's very entertaining for Him. God doesn't have an ego. He doesn't need to be praised. We don't pray or praise God in our prayers because it makes God feel good. These are all human projections. God is completely perfect. Why would a perfect being need to create anything? It's only because we believe that God wanted to bestow goodness. Because God is good, He's all benevolent, and that is a great principle of the Jewish faith. That God is all about giving. We learn to give from God. And since God has no choice other than to give, He willed us into existence, but then He created us as physical beings. Why did He create us? Why didn't He just make us angels? He gives us a body and a soul so they can keep battling it out. And every time you have an ethical dilemma in your life, you got the guy with a little white halo over his head going, "Do this." And then you got the guy with a pitchfork dressed, he's always dressed in black, a little fire, you know, and he's like, "Do this." There's the body part of you that's pulling you down, that's a little more base and selfish and self-absorbed. And then there's this like good spiritual side of you that just wants to be connected with something greater. God creates this conflict situation within us. But the Kabbalists teach, because God wants there to be spirituality in the most, in the strangest of places. Because spirituality existed already before you and I came into the world. Before there was a physical finite existence, all there was, we believe, was God. So if He creates something physical, it's because He wants His holiness. He wants His spirituality to be in something not holy, not spiritual. So the more we bring holiness into the physical, the more we involve the Torah and its rules and its laws in our everyday physical life, the more we are accomplishing the very purpose of our existence. Right? God's already holy. He's already got all of His angels. They're super, uber holy. What He wants is holiness in physicality. He wants holiness in unlikely places. And that's why He needs us, in a sense. God is reliant on us to bring His holiness into places. And He'll say, "Well, why do you have to make it so difficult?" Because we have to choose it. And the great Ramchal, Rabbeinu Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, another great Kabbalist from Italian descent, wrote this again and again, that we have to choose it. And if we don't choose it, it never becomes ours. That's the difference between us and the angels. When we choose it, and that's why we have opposing forces, and they're really, if the choice is not real, meaning if there isn't as much tension between the different sides of who we are, on any given ethical dilemma in our lives, and it just came easily, we don't grow from it. We only grow, it's like the gym, we only grow when there's tension, and when we tear some muscle in the process. Yeah, you had your hand up, please.
Yeah, just thinking about it, actually, last week, from my perspective, apart from God's wanting to escape the physical life, right, and embrace what is spiritual, or my essence, my soul, and just saying all this is like dread, is just, you know, what is this, this terrible world?
It's schmutz, right.
So there's something very romantic about that, and I'm very much that type, because I always all go with my feelings, and what do I, you know, what is this role day to day?
But then you have to ask yourself, why were you putting it in the beginning?
So I tell that from my perspective, even. So, or from a religious one. So if I say this is schmutz, right? All the, I don't know what, the physical world, this terrible, you know, whatever. Then I'm profaning the name of God, because I'm saying, you're okay, but this thing you created, it's not so good. So you didn't do so well there. But you did okay with the spiritual. So, like, sanctifying the physical life is, in a way, is like sanctifying God's name.
Sure.
Because I'm saying all of your creation, somehow I know all of your creation is good, even this thing that will such months.
And I'll tell you, it's very well said. Thank you for sharing that. And not only that, where do you think that physical stuff came from? Everything has its root ultimately in God. There's no such thing, you know, the Kabbalah speaks about four types of existence: mineral, plant, animal, human. All of that comes from God, right? So these are all creations of God. There must have been some positive purpose for their existence. Yes.
Name of the class of person, but it's the person who chooses not to drink wine.
Yeah, the Nazir. It's a very good question. It's a very, very good question. So, is everyone, Andrew? See, this is why I write down. I drew your names in crayon, by the way. This is what I had. So, Andrew's asking a very good question. If the whole point is not to negate the physical world, but to be involved in it and bring spirituality in the physical world, then why do we have this weird personality? Has anyone heard of the Nazir? The Nazir is this person, a man or a woman, who for a certain period of time takes upon themselves not to drink wine, cut their hair, or come into contact with the dead for a certain period of time. Could be 30 days, could be a year. Famous Nazir from the Torah was Shimshon, was mighty Samson. So why does God give us such a personality? It's a really good question. If the goal is not to escape the physical finite world, but to imbue it with spirituality, then why are we praising the Nazir? You have an answer?
I think so. I think it's because, it might be because I think some people have like a really strong maybe inclination toward or temptation to do something that might be considered the wrong way or not the best with the physical, and this is an opportunity for those people who really struggle with that.
Excellent. So I'm actually going to use what Barry just said, because I can ask a bigger question. Why did God say we can't partake of certain physical things at all? If the physical world is all about being redeemed and being spiritualized, then let's go anywhere and everywhere. Let's go to the worst possible places. And why does God restrict us from eating certain things or from working on the seventh day? Why say no to anything then? So and I think the answer to that is kind of what Barry, you were just touching on, because then we will be controlled by those things, and then we can't infuse them or make them holy. You can't inspire something unless you can somehow manipulate it in some way, in a positive way. But if that thing is controlling you, and that is the danger in that, by the way, Judaism takes a big chance in this sense, because you figure that the safe way out is just to say, stay away from physicality. Right? God gave you a body and a soul. The body is what's keeping you down. The soul is what's connecting you to God. Just negate all the physicality. So the Torah is telling us, by the way, the Torah never denies any physical pleasure entirely. It restricts it. The Torah doesn't say don't have sex. But it does tell us sex with A, B, or C is appropriate and D, E, and F is not. Why is that? Why doesn't the Torah just say, bring spirituality everywhere? Because, and I'm going to answer your question with the Nazir the same way, which is to say that, because then we'll be consumed by it. And then we won't be able to bring the kind of holiness that we were created to bring to the physical world, because we will be overpowered. And that is you got to know yourself a little. And that's what the Nazir is, by the way. The Nazir is an option for people, Nachmanides writes this, for gluttons, let's say, for someone who's overly physical and needs to pull back a little more. But if we think that pulling back is the definition of holiness, then we're missing the whole point. The definition of holiness is inspiring physicality, imbuing our physical bodies and our physical lives and this world with God's sanctity and holiness. And that's why Judaism has very little literature about the world to come, messianic era, resurrection of the dead, all things we fundamentally believe in. Maimonides put all those three things in his 13 principles of faith. But very little biblical or rabbinic literature on those areas, because the goal of our existence is not what happens when we die. or not what happens when the Mashiach comes, or not what happens after the resurrection of the dead. The most important thing is, how do you live your life right here and right now? Are you bringing holiness into your everyday life at work, at home, in the kitchen, in the bedroom? That, as far as Judaism is concerned, I think that that's what Judaism's unique contribution to being a holy person is about. And by the way, it's much more difficult. Because in a sense, it would be simpler. It would be hard and to be very restrictive. Once you get used to the restrictions, that's it. You know you can't do anything. Right? But saying you can do this, but don't do that. And the reason for that is because we want you to stay involved in this activity. We want you to go out and earn a living. And we know when you go out and earn a living, there's going to be some pretty competitive people there. And they're going to try all sorts of things, and it's going to be really hard to make money, and you're going to have all these challenges about the way you deal with others at work. Same thing with relationship building. It's difficult. But can we be holy about the way we deal with each other? Romantically? Platonically? I would argue that that's harder than staying in synagogue praying all day. You think Yom Kippur's hard? Because you're fasting all day and you're praying all day? I think it's much more challenging to be a good Jew, as they say, at work, at home. That is really where the test of holiness comes in. And that's the most beautiful thing in the world, you think about it, because then God is really partnering with us. Then God is saying, okay, I've got the spiritual world covered. I'm going to give you a physical world. Let's see how well you do energizing this spirit, this physical world with some spirituality. Or are you going to get so sucked into the physical that you're not, that it's just going to take you over, as opposed to you and I, all of us, trying to inspire the physical world with spirituality, with holiness. If you want to read a great contemporary rabbi who wrote about this, he was also a poet, and he wrote in very poetic terms. He was the first chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook. One of his favorite words he used in his writings was to redeem. There was nothing in this world that he felt was irredeemable. And he very much believed that, you know, and I'll tell you a weird thing. I mean, I don't know, this might like freak you out a little, but we, the Kabbalists, go to town on this. They believe that you're actually redeeming the physical objects. I'll tell you one little story. You may not appreciate it so much, but I remember, just because, so when I was young and I got my first pair of tefillin, I got it from a gentleman named Eisenbach. He should live and be well. He's a little Hasidic gentleman in Meir Shearim in Jerusalem, very religious section of Jerusalem. And not only was I, my dad brought me my tefillin there, but my father went with all of my three boys to buy their tefillin. And he's a very, very holy man, and he also collects money for people that are poor. So people come to him to give because he's a very honest person, so everybody trusts him. And I went back with my son Yehuda, who's 18 now. So we were there probably 6 years ago to buy his pair of tefillin. And I noticed that my leather straps and my tefillin are starting to like fade a little. They're, you know, they're from my bar mitzvah a couple years ago. So I said, look, while I'm here, I'd like to get new, what's called ritzuot. I want to get the new straps. So he looked at them and he said, you know, I don't think you need to change them yet. So I said, oh, I appreciate that, but I don't know when I'm going to get back here. You know, he's open like every other Tuesday from 3 to 3:30. You ever see these shops in Meir Shearim? It's like, you know, and I don't know when I'm going to get back. So he says, well, I'm sorry, I don't feel comfortable selling them to you. And I thought it was like an honesty thing because he's ridiculously honest. And I have another crazy story about that, I'll tell you. Nothing to do with this class, though. But he said, no, it has nothing to do with honesty. He says, it's just that the cow from where this leather was taken is going to wear you out a little. May not continue to have a spiritual elevation through the mitzvah you're observing with its hide. If you don't, you know, if you discard it when it's still mitzvah user friendly, so to speak, you could still use it as a mitzvah kind of thing. I was like, what? And then he gave me this whole thing, and I've been learning this for the last couple of years, that when we use any, this is from a tree, and if I put, I guess if I put a Jewish book on this, and I'm teaching some Torah, usually for a mitzvah. And that's why these Chabad guys will stop you in the middle of the street and ask you if you put on tefillin. Now, and I used to be very cynical. I was like, what are you guys doing? This guy may not even believe in God. You're wrapping leather or straps around his arm. What are you accomplishing? But they very much believe that the physical boxes, these leather boxes with the parchment written with the Torah scroll, with words from the Torah on them, that the physical things themselves are being elevated because, and they're all being returned to their original source in God. Because everything in the finite physical world, whether it's a piece of wood, whether it's a human being, whether it's leather on a tefillin strap, is ultimately from Hashem. And by using it in a mitzvah, you're elevating it. You're imbuing it with spirituality. You're making that thing holy. You're not just getting holy yourself. But the physical inanimate objects, according to Kabbalah, also become holy. And if you said that to me 10 years ago, I would have laughed. I would have thought that was a silly idea. But it's very much embedded in the Kabbalistic tradition. So literally, so you ask somebody, what is the purpose of our existence spiritually? It's to imbue the physical world with spirituality. And when we say the physical world, we don't just mean people. We mean like everything. Literally everything is potentially redeemable and could be returned back to its original spiritual source. Because if you think about it, everything originally started with God. That's all there was, we believe. Okay, I know it's late and I'm getting a little crazy. I'll tell you one last story though about it. What's it? Everything was in Hebrew, which was really complicated. It was all in Hebrew.
Because the Nashemite, they don't know how to speak Hebrew. So I was wondering about it.
So I'll tell you one last. Any other questions, please? Just about. Yeah, Barry.
I've been thinking about pulling the Kiddush out of total crux, but I guess how do you define. I've heard different definitions of how, like, the translator had just. How do you define pulling the Kiddush?
I mean, I think the ability to. To put it into words, you know, everything we've been saying is somehow returning something physical to its spiritual source. That would be one thing. Returning something physical to its spiritual source and imbuing anything that where God isn't, bringing God to that. Bringing God to whatever part of our life, which is really light. Because we look at physicality as darkness and we look at God as light. So the more we're able to infuse the darkness with light, that's creating holiness. Any other comments or questions? Can I just tell you one last story about this guy, which is very, very powerful. So one of the first times I met him, I was with my wife and oldest son when he was an infant. And we were in the store. Has anyone been to these like little dusty shops in Mea Shearim in Jerusalem?
Yeah.
So we were there, and I was in the store maybe 5 minutes, and our son was like wailing, hungry. And I went over to him, and I asked him very politely, is there a place for my wife to be able to nurse? And I didn't really know this person like... So he says to me in Hebrew, "He tzrichat ze achshav," which means she needs this now. And I'm like, "Yeah." So he says, "There's no other place for her to do this." And he starts kicking all of the different customers that were looking at the different Judaica parts of his shop. He starts like kicking people out of the shop. I was like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "There's no other place." He starts kicking him out, and then he hands me this like wad of keys, and he starts showing me I can lock him out from his store. He gave me the keys to his store, and then before he left, he poured my wife a cup of water, and he said to me, because it was like very, he said, "Zenaki," he said, "This is clean," and I'm so sorry, and he's like, this is why we're here. So okay, so he left. I locked him out. I actually locked him out of his store. My wife did her thing. Everybody was happy. And then I opened up the door and I said, thank you so much. And before he came in, my wife was like, you better buy something from this guy. So by the time he came into the room, I had like all this stuff like on the counter ready to... I thanked him and then I said, you know, just let me know what this costs, you know. So he says, I'm sorry, I can't sell you any of these things. I was like, what do you mean? He says... I'm not interested. I wanted to do you. I picked up a pair of tzitzis. I said, I need this, actually. I want to buy this. So he starts telling me where I can find. There's another store around there. He's like a terrible businessman. So I said, I don't understand. I really want to buy. He says, listen, I just did a chesed for you. I just performed an act of kindness. If that act of kindness is to remain pure, I cannot receive anything in return. And that means more to me than whatever money you're willing to spend. And I left. I left the store. All we did in the store was nurse our son. Okay, and I left the store paying nothing, and it was pretty powerful. It's nothing to do with. That's a pretty holy thing to do. Okay. That's a pretty holy action. Yeah. What's that?
Turn the physical shop into a physical.
Yeah. Pretty unbelievable. Yeah. I'll tell you one other crazy story. My friend, and we'll let you guys go because it's late. My friend Jay Zachter, who's on Wall Street, he was in the same neighborhood on Friday morning trying to buy chalot for Shabbat. So he walks into the place like 9 in the morning and like the shelves are clear. There's like nothing left. So he goes over to the guy and he says, like, I want to buy chalot. He's like, we're cleared out by 8 in the morning on Fridays. So he says, my friend says, I mean, are there people like me that come in after 8? Oh, so many people keep coming in all day. So my friend's like, he's a Wall Street. He's like, let me get this straight. You know more people are coming in. Why don't you just bake more challah? What do you think he said? He said, you think I'm the only one who earns a living by selling challah? They have to feed their families too. I have enough. Now, I'm not saying we need to do that, and I know that probably rubs up against our Adam Smith capitalistic tendencies. But it's that's like there are people who live this way, actually.
Chavetz Chaim. It's a story about the Chavetz Chaim. That once you open the shop, once you earn the money to survive today, it was closed in the shop.
Yeah, because he realized the Chavetz Chaim, one of the Rabbi Israel Meir Kagan, lived in the late 1800s, early 1900s in Poland. Very poor, and he inherited a large sum of money from his aunt who passed away, and he bought a store, and that's how he earned his living. He used to sit in the back of the store and study, and his wife ran the store. But once in a while, he would come out to help her, and he was very famous. So it guaranteed an unusually large number of customers, because Chafetz Chaim, whether they liked the stuff they were selling or not, but you get to see this big rabbi, he realized that, and he insisted on closing the store when they had what they needed, because he wanted to take business away from other people around him. The truth is, I was thinking like these stories have nothing to do with our topic tonight, but the truth is they're not required. By the way, none of these, like the guy who I bought my tefillin for, he didn't have to kick those people out and lose all that business. The Chafetz Chaim didn't have to close, but he went beyond what was required, and in doing so he really did infuse, I think, some holiness, you know, into his business dealings, you know. And I'd like to believe also that, you know, when we act this way towards each other, we're going to see some blessing materially as well. I'll say this, and it takes me a few times to conclude, I keep saying I'm going to finish, but Meyer Offman was a member of our board at MGE for many years, and he said to me that the more he gave, and he showed me a verse in the Torah that implies this, that the more charity he gave, the more money he made. He was a very wealthy guy. He helped us out significantly in a lot of other organizations. And he said that that was his experience. I didn't do a poll. I didn't ask like all the big Jewish philanthropists. But he said to me that he was always giving because he knew you had to give. But then he started giving more because he started seeing he was making more. Every time he kept giving more, he was making more. So I don't know. I mean, don't like give away all your money tonight and then blame it on me because you're broke.
You know, but
it's coming week.
Aser to Aser. Yeah. Yeah. All right, so next week we're going to continue with a discussion on Thanksgiving, I believe. And then we're going to do Chanukah. We're going to have two classes on Chanukah, have some really great material. Oh, I think it's maybe Chanukah next week.
No, it's the
Attitude of Gratitude next week. Okay. All right, great. Well, any other questions or comments? Everyone knows what it means to be holy now. So let's just do it. Let's just keep all the mitzvahs, no problem. Simple, right? quick announcement. Anybody's interested, every Friday night we have FNL, Friday Night Lights, 6:30. And Shabbat morning at 9:30 I'll be speaking. I'm still working on what I'm talking about. But I encourage you to come. It's always a fun time. And we have sushi Friday night and a hot kiddush on Saturday. And a dinner, by the way. My good friend Richard Bernstein is speaking this Friday night. Richard Bernstein is one of the most inspirational people I've ever met. I'm not just saying that to get you to come to the dinner. He is a motivational speaker who I actually had the honor of going to Israel with him for the first time he ever traveled there. He's completely blind. He's been blind his whole life. But is a marathon runner, is an Ironman, did the Ironman when he was younger, and is now a federal court judge and a very, very impressive person. You want to hear this guy. I've heard him speak many times. He's a very inspirational guy. He lives here in the city. Goes back and forth to Michigan where he's a judge. So if anybody's interested in signing up for the dinner, I think Aliyah's outside, or you can just go online, Jewish Experience, and sign up. And thank you for being here. I wish you lots of holiness.
Thank you.
A great night, everyone. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Please eat some more kosher pizza. Make your holy. Do I turn this off? This.
Go beyond the letter of the law.
Beyond
the letter of the law.
That was an excellent point.
We have 101 Wednesday night.
Part of the
I think we got For me, yeah.
Years,
Also, Spani.
I think it's Spani.
I think it's Spani.